ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of the Politics Now podcast. And navigating what our rapidly changing world means can be tricky.
I do think you're right to point to the ability of the backbench in Britain to agitate, be upset with Keir Starmer. That's one of the reasons he's gone.
That's why I'm joined by the sharpest political minds at the ABC to break down what each development means for Australia and how the government is positioning.
Albanese has got a much more compliant backbench and he's got much more dominance of the Parliament just because of peculiar Australian features of our system.
That's Politics Now with me, Patricia Carvelis. Find it on ABC Listen.
So much on. We know Donald Trump loves a tariff, and according to his administration, a slew of new ones are set to hit 60 countries this afternoon. Australia is on the list with a 12.5% tariff that will be imposed on Australian exports to the US. Now, you won't believe the grounds, but the question is the impact. And how does Australia's tariff square with those on other countries? Meanwhile, Brent crude oil has hit US $100 a barrel for the first time since May. What does that mean for petrol prices here at home? And the news really never does sleep, with key tech stocks tanking on the US market overnight. With such a lot of economic news about this morning, we wanted to break it all down. Ring the alarm. It's a special bonus episode of ABC Business Daily. I'm Daniel Ziffer.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor, Michael Yander.
Well, we woke up and there was a lot that happened overnight and we just had to talk about it. What is going on? I got on the bike, Michael.
I jumped on the bus.
Okay.
Hurried in this morning after being on a slew of conference calls and having to do a lot of talking because pretty much every big news item today is about business and economics and global finance.
I was going to meet a contact and they did say that I had to cancel because the oil price being over $100 US was the best excuse they had heard all year. So here we are. Let's start with the basics. We'll start with tariffs. What have we heard from the Trump administration overnight about new levies that will replace the 10% tariff that was set to expire that we spoke about on yesterday's pod with Amelia, where some Australian companies were getting refunds already? What's happening now?
Yeah, so that 10% tariff, which was already replacing the Liberation Day tariffs, which had been ruled by the US Supreme Court to be illegal and have resulted in well over $100 billion US dollars in refunds going to companies around the world who'd paid those tariffs that were illegal. So Trump then brought in these tariffs that operated on a 90-day limit. That limit expires on Friday US time. And so today, overnight, early this morning Australian time, the US administration has announced a slew of new tariffs on 60 countries in an effort to reduce forced labour around the world. That's the excuse that's being labelled to use Section 301 of the Trade Act 1974 to impose these tariffs. The real reason seems to be that it is the most legally durable way the Trump administration has so far hit on to implement what he wants to do anyway, which is a blanket minimum 10% tariff basically on every country in the world, and then higher tariffs on particular goods from particular countries.
Now, this has been mooted for a while. The Australian government, the Business Council have been making submissions, pushing back on this. Australia is one of the countries that has done quite a lot in the fight against forced labour and what is sometimes called modern slavery. When countries are ranked as to how much effort they're putting in, the laws they've passed, the prosecutions, we're in the top tier. We're in a higher tier than some countries that are getting lower tariffs out of this. Is this an attempt to undo or essentially reimpose tariffs that have been struck out by the court? Is this more likely to last longer?
It does seem the early legal commentary is that these are more durable. This section of the Trade Act has been used previously, including in the previous Trump administration, to introduce tariffs against, for instance, China that weren't struck down. What is novel, though, and what we're reading in US media reporting who have spoken to legal experts, is how widely these tariffs are being applied. This blanket 10 to 12.5% tariff on 60 different countries who are all accused of having weak positions against the use of forced labor or modern slavery. This hasn't been done before, and it is likely to be subject to legal challenge again. And as you mentioned, our colleague Amelia Turzon did some excellent reporting just about a week ago on the challenge to the original Liberation Day tariffs. She actually spoke to the US lawyer who is in the legal firm that ran that case, a conservative legal firm that took on Trump and won. They were saying they were going to challenge the next 90-day tariffs, and presumably they will be looking at a challenge to this latest method of introducing tariffs as well. So there is likely to be more court action to, and there could well be more refunds in the offing if the court does find that these two are basically a ruse or an excuse for the US president to impose tariffs without going through Congress and doing it unilaterally.
As with so many of the topics we discuss on this podcast, great news for lawyers everywhere. So the US Supreme Court earlier ruled that those tariffs imposed under those emergency powers were illegal. This new round is a way to get around it. But even then, it's still not even. We are getting, for example, a higher rate than a lot of other countries that are getting a 10% tariff. What's the explanation behind that?
Well, the apparent explanation is that we haven't done much to reduce or prevent the importation of goods that have been produced with forced labour. But as you pointed out, Dan, Australia actually has some of the world's strongest protections against modern slavery. We were one of the early adopters bringing in a Modern Slavery Act to force large companies to report on their supply chains and whether there was the risk of forced labour in those supply chains. From recollection, the government has only just recently strengthened or plans to strengthen laws in this area to impose even tougher penalties on companies that don't follow those modern slavery laws. So I imagine there's a lot of back and forth between Canberra and Washington, D.C. on why Australia's been whacked with 12.5% when countries like the United Kingdom, which has very similar laws to us, are getting 10%. The European Union's getting 10%. Taiwan, which of course is a big source of U.S. tech imports such as chips, that's getting 10%. Other countries on the 10% list include countries like Mexico, for instance. So why is Australia getting 12.5%? I think Argentina also is on the 10% yes. list. The president there is a good friend of Donald Trump, so whether that has something to do with it. And that's obviously a threat to Australia because one of our big exports to the US is beef. And one of Argentina's big products as well is beef.
When we talk about the assessment of modern slavery, it's important to note we're talking about a report that is created by the State Department of the US government about ranking these different countries. We have worked before with the US when these trade restrictions have been discussed. The Prime Minister was criticised for a long time about not being able to get a meeting in the White House, but then we did actually get some movement on tariffs that were going to be imposed. Do you think that that is the aim here, that essentially this is what President Trump is trying to do, is to essentially set up a series of deals, and this is what he's tried before, and that this is just another go around at that, where countries have to slice and dice their own particular deal?
Yeah, I mean, there's not too much to deal with here, Dan. It looks like they want a 10% base basically on everything, which is pretty consistent with what Donald Trump's been pushing for from Liberation Day onwards. It is actually consistent with some economic theory around optimal tariff levels, which do find that tariffs around 10% potentially aren't economically damaging to the country that's imposing them, particularly when they're a large, powerful market like the US, and actually therefore do fall more on the country that is doing the exporting to the US and could be a good revenue raiser for the US. I mean, the amount of refunds the Trump administration's had to hand back from the Liberation Day illegal tariffs illustrate just how much they've contributed to the US budget over the 9 months or so that they were in place before they got struck out. So they're definitely looking for a budget boost. We know Donald Trump loves tariffs. This is another excuse to bring them in. Maybe Australia can go from 12.5% back to 10%, but we're unlikely to go any lower. And realistically, is the 2.5% difference going to make a make or break for Australian exporters compared with, say, rivals like Argentina? You know, 2.5% on your beef is probably not enough to stop American consumers buying Australian.
Now, ironically, according to the Trade Minister, Don Farrell, who spoke to ABC News this morning, in the period since the so-called Liberation Day tariffs, which were about April last year, we're now exporting 67% more product into the United States. How's that happening when we're facing this, we have been facing this increased cost?
Well, in one word, gold, Dan. a very large component in that surge of imports into the US from Australia was gold imports, because of the threat that the Trump administration might impose specific tariffs around precious metals. And there was a big rush to bring a whole heap of gold into the US last year. So that was a major contributor. Previously, of course, Trump's Liberation Day tariffs did hit some countries much harder than 10 or 12.5%. And so Australia had a relative advantage compared to some of those. But yes, that's essentially the reason. We've got a bunch of stuff that the US can't easily get elsewhere in the quantities it requires. And so, you know, at tariff levels of 10 or 12.5%, we're still competitive enough.
Well, from one commodity to another, I told you it'd been a busy day. Overnight, Brent crude also hit US $100 a barrel for the first time since May. We know what's been driving that, but why has it gone up so much?
Again, in one word, the Houthis. So they've been sitting there in the background. They're a rebel group in Yemen. Yemen borders Saudi Arabia on the south. Unfortunately for Saudi Arabia, Yemen also borders the Red Sea at the point where it is narrowest. So we already know Iran has blocked the Strait of Hormuz, along with the US, which is blockading Iran's access to that strait. So oil and gas from the east side of the Middle East is not getting out through the Strait of Hormuz. What the Saudis have been doing is piping about 5 million barrels a day of oil from the east to the west through this pipeline that they built many years ago, and they've been increasing exports through the Red Sea. Now, the problem they've got is that the Houthi rebels, with whom Saudi Arabia has been in conflict for many years, and they are a proxy of the Iranians and supported by the Iranian regime, they have now declared a blockade earlier this week against Saudi Arabia. And how this has escalated even further is that they've actually started enforcing that blockade. There have been now reports of two Saudi ships, oil tankers, that have been attacked by the Houthi rebels, one of which sustained a hit and damage. That report of that ship has been confirmed by various Saudi outlets. That was in one of the southern ports as the ship was leaving. And so now what the Houthis are doing is blocking the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb. And that is basically the exit on the south side from the Red Sea to get Saudi oil out to Asia. Now, if the Saudis want to keep sending oil out through the Red Sea without risk of attack, they're going to have to go through the north and send that oil from the port of Yanbu, which is further up the Saudi coast and away from Yemen. It's also where the east-west pipeline comes out. But they're going to then have to put that on smaller tankers that can fit through the Suez Canal. And if that oil is going to Asia, that oil is going to have to sail all the way through the Mediterranean Sea, all the way down the west coast of Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope, through the Indian Ocean. So that's adding weeks to the journey of oil, Saudi oil, to Asia, and a lot of cost. So that is why oil prices are back above $100 a barrel.
Michael, do you think that this year has given business some cause to think that maybe being entirely reliant on a sticky, dangerous, hard to transport substance from one of the most volatile areas on earth might not be the best idea?
Consumers have definitely got the message, because we've seen EV sales absolutely surging in Australia from a very low base, to the point where, as our colleague Ian Verinder has written in a great article that it's worth reading today, about how the Chinese EV makers are absolutely slaughtering the European Japanese and US auto industries, the market is now there for those EVs because people are conscious of the unreliability of fuel supplies, the potential for rationing if this continues for much longer, and certainly the cost at the bowser, which we're likely to see rise dramatically given the price of the raw material has now surged from about $71-72 US a barrel a couple of weeks ago at the low point when everything looked like it might be resolved. We're now back over 100 in the space of a couple of weeks.
Now, we do have a lag because most of our liquid fuel is purchased in Singapore. We refine a tiny amount here, about 10 to 20% or so. So it's not going to be an immediate jump, but it certainly looks like on the very near horizon for people like myself who pump petrol into their car to get around, those prices are going to rise substantially soon.
Yes, I think that's pretty much baked in. And then, of course, the government's remaining cut to the fuel excise is currently scheduled to expire on August the 2nd, which, unless the government decides to extend that, which they may well do, given the current circumstances, that will add another 16 cents a litre to petrol and diesel costs, which are already likely to be pushing over $2 a litre for petrol and heading back towards that $3 a litre level for diesel, given that oil prices are now back to where they were in late May before the ceasefire and when there were still concerns about genuine global shortages of not only oil but the refined products made from them. Many of those refined products, again, as a great piece Ian wrote about a week ago, many of those refined products are even in greater shortage because they are refined in the Middle East and can't get out, and there isn't the refining capacity elsewhere to make up the shortfall. And particularly for diesel, where a lot of Russian refineries have been hit by the Ukraine as part of that conflict and they're out of action. And Russia was a major exporter of diesel to the global market. That's basically offline because they're having to keep all the fuel supplies in Russia. Turkey's banned diesel exports. You know, there's a lot of crunch points all hitting at once again. We will see fuel prices rise.
The RBA meets mid-August. All of this feeds into inflation. It makes a much more difficult meeting that they have in about a week and a half. How much of an impact do you think these kind of moves have on their thinking when they see this conflict becoming seemingly intractable and the resulting oil prices?
Well, the market certainly thinks the odds of a rate hike have gone up substantially, and there's a lot of flux around that. The unemployment figures that were quite strong yesterday, strong jobs numbers feeding into that, the oil price rise feeding into that, tariffs from the US feeding into global price pressures. Everything's pointing in the same direction that inflation is not coming down, certainly not coming down as quickly as the Reserve Bank wants. Interestingly, Michelle Bullock is doing a significant annual speech next Tuesday. I'm going to be down there with Kirsten Aiken from the business as well. That is to the Australian Business Economist. As you say, that's about a week ahead of the next Reserve Bank board meeting, which should give us some insight into the RBA's current thinking on where the Australian economy is at, but also how these global factors are playing into the inflation outlook and the interest rate outlook for Australia. We definitely won't see a cut in interest rates when the Reserve Bank next meets, but the odds of a rate hike taking the cash rate to 4.6% have certainly gone up a lot. And if this heats up in the Middle East further, that's not going to do anything to diminish those risks.
Well, that's what might be going up. What is going down is share prices in the US, especially big, well-known tech stocks. What happened overnight?
Yeah, so Dan, we saw some of the big tech names fall heavily. Alphabet down more than 7%. Basically on spending a lot more on AI infrastructure like data centers and servers. The spending was way higher than analysts had expected and also meant that the company had fallen into negative cash flow. They were spending more than they're bringing in. And this goes to some of these fears about the debts that big US tech firms are racking up to expand AI. Tesla sank 15% after its free cash flow also turned negative, again on massive investments. The NASDAQ was down more than 2%. Part of that's also this fear about rising interest rates, not only the potential for a rate rise in Australia, but This will renew the potential for a rate rise sometime this year in the US. And if rates go up, it means those tech company valuations kind of mechanically go down because they need to achieve bigger profits to justify their inflated share prices. And that's why we saw the NASDAQ down more than 2%, the S&P 500 down more than 1%, and the Dow Jones also down about 1%. So some pretty big sell-offs on US shares.
It's one of the big enduring questions of our AI age is, can they all possibly win? It seems unlikely.
Yeah, I mean, you can bet on the sector as a whole, I guess, but even if AI ends up paying off, the history of, you know, say the internet, the dot-com boom, yes, some companies survived and prospered. Let's say you're Amazon, and if you'd stuck with Amazon, you've profited handsomely. But for every company that survived and prospered and dominated the global market, dozens and dozens of startups fell by the wayside. Let's think your, what's a good example? Your Netspace or your MySpace, which was bought out by News Corporation. Some of these things just died a very quick and painful death.
Well, we shall see. That's it for this special bonus episode of ABC Business Daily. Now, that's Business with Alan Kohler. We'll be in your feed this afternoon. An interview with ACCC boss Gina Cass-Gottlieb. You don't want to miss it. Now, make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send us in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. That's abcbusinessdaily, all one word, at abc.net.au. Mike, great to chat.
Catch you Monday, Dan.